This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. New parents often receive a stack of how-to books, which often do little to calm their anxieties. Afflicted by fear that they may be doing it wrong, they turn to the experts. This one cites the latest brain research, that one the wisdom of grandmothers. One encourages parents to impose discipline, the other to relax. Some experts used to advise that too much cuddling with your child could spoil them. What about the family bed? Baby in or baby out? In a new book called Raising America, writer Ann Hulbert says that neither the anxiety nor the contradictory advice is anything new. Experts have been explaining how to raise your child for 100 years now, and broadly, they've stood in one of two camps, soft or stern. Nearly all cited scientific evidence to support their claims, and Americans devoured their every word. Today, childcare books are a major genre. Haven't we figured this out yet? Later in the program, we'll talk about Michael Jordan's abrupt departure from the Washington Wizards basketball team, and writer John Feinstein will join us to talk about the difficulties that great athletes face when they try to transfer their skills to the front office. But first, experts, parents, and a century of advice about children. Who did your parents turn to, and how did it work? And if you're a parent yourself, call and tell us what books you've read and why, and whether they've helped to resolve the doubts about crying and toilet training and the terrible twos and all the rest. Or maybe you call your mom. Do you have doubts about the experts? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Ann Hulbert's new book is Raising America. She's with us here today in Studio 3A. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to begin by asking you about the background to this. It started a century ago. Why then?
Well, of course, there have been child-rearing advisors for eons. The ones one come right to mind are grandmothers, of course. And in 19th century America, it was ministers who spent a lot of time talking to mothers about what they should do with their children. But there was suddenly a new breed of experts who arrived on the scene at about the turn of the century, and they were responding to a new set of dilemmas and challenges that seem to confront mothers and experts themselves. I think the sort of simple way to summarize the big changes that were happening in this country were urbanization was happening at a pace that it had never happened before. Industrialization was underway and immigration was on the rise, and the status of women was changing. Mm-hmm. So it was a whole new set of circumstances facing people. Families were smaller, and not least, science, the prestige of science was on the rise at the same time that the authority of religion was on the wane.
There's this wonderful citation you have in your book of a piece of the New York Times about a conference, and that this would settle the issues, the scientific issues, that we would know how to raise children properly, and of course science, it goes on to say, would settle all the other ills on earth.
Right. There was a hugely sort of messianic hope that if only children could be raised well and scientifically, then all the social woes would disappear from the face of the earth.
Now, there were two founding fathers, really, I guess, of child-rearing advice. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, one of them was named Dr. Luther Emmett Holt, and the other one was named Dr. G. Stanley Hall. It's confusing, Holt and Hall, but Holt was a pediatrician, both of them, and Hall was a psychologist. Both of them started out their lives as farm boys and made their trip into the city. So they were basically experiencing what many Americans at the same time were. They left rural origins, came to the big city, pursued what was at that point the fast-track profession. They were pioneers in scientific fields. They went to Europe, gathered the latest advice from European experts, came back, and were ready to hold forth. And not only that, they confronted an audience of mothers who seemed to be eager to help them, and they were actually eager for the help of mothers in their enterprise.
And they came to symbolize, I guess, the dichotomy, the two camps, the stern and the soft.
They absolutely did. Dr. Holt, who was the pediatrician, was the hard dad figure in this mom-dad duo, if you want to think about it that way. And his little book, which he called a catechism, was very strictly enunciated principles on how to feed your child, which was no small question at that point. The infant mortality rate at the turn of the century was still quite high. 1 in 6 children died before they turned 5, and half of those before they turned 1. He had formulas, and he was going to present them to mothers, and mothers were going to be able to keep their children healthy. Dr. Hall was a completely different kettle of fish. He was a psychologist who was fascinated by the mysterious unfolding of children's natures and was embarked on a project to uncover the secrets and mysteries of development. He was the romantic, soft alternative to Hall.
And one of the great ideas of the time was that motherhood itself was a vocation.
Absolutely. One of the great projects that these medical experts and scientific experts offered to mothers was that they, too, could become scientific in the way they brought up their children. Instead of being guided by uncertain instinct, which was what they referred to as the sort of 19th century way of doing things, they would be guided by unhesitating insight, and it would become a rational intellectual undertaking, which was going to be very rewarding and itself basically a career, a profession that would keep possibly otherwise restless mothers who were now quite well educated content to stay at home and raise their children rather than stream outward in search of a career, as one conference of concerned people put it.
We're speaking of the then burgeoning middle class mothers.
Absolutely, yes.
There was a lot of differences in terms of class.
Yes, this was definitely in its origins and actually throughout the century a very middle class enterprise. But of course in America, everyone wants to belong to the middle class, which is part of why this genre has been as popular as it is.
Mm-hmm. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we go to the phones? Our first caller is Christina, who's with us from Indianapolis.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Christina. I'm a mother of three boys, and I've consulted many books on raising boys, including because I have no idea what it's like to be a boy. What I've found is that it really depends on the child, and what I always resort to is my own instinct. All the child-rearing books in the world don't really help me. They give me ideas, but really my instinct on how to raise each of my children is what, in the end, will apply.
Whose books did you read, and why did you turn to them?
Well, I've read Dobson, who has a book called Bringing Up Boys. There's another one called Real Boys. I can't remember the author right now. And I've also read Brazelton and a couple of others, What to Expect, you know, The Toddler Years. And all of them, I find, only increase my own paranoia that I'm not doing right by my children. And so, at the end of the day, if my children have had a good day, that's all that counts to me. And I don't need to be a paranoid mother. I just need to know that my children are nurtured and well played with and learning. So, any comments to that?
I think what's sort of an entertaining story to tell. We tend to think that mothers are completely enthralled to experts and quavering at their every word. And Dr. Spock, actually, at one point in his career, it was in the early 50s, decided he really would like to know how it is that people actually use the book that he had written and that kind of advice, because the truth is it's the great mystery that advisors themselves don't know the answer to. And he set up what was not a very controlled or carefully designed study, but he brought a lot of different families in. He was in the Cleveland hospitals at this point, and had them surveyed for several years and took lots of notes and tried to elicit from them a sense of what use they made of his kind of expertise. And the conclusion he drew, really much to his surprise, was that honestly, they didn't seem to make too much of his advice. They went ahead and did what they were going to do. And in fact, as he said, I'm quite impressed at the way they're able to handle situations as they arise. And we tend to underestimate how well parents judge the needs of their own particular children in their own situation. And he wrote a letter to Anna Freud, actually, it's very funny, saying, you know, it's a little bit painful to discover that, you know, parents are as good at this as they are.
Well, thank you. I tend to agree with that, and I think that in the end, I really just rely on commiserating with other mothers, knowing that I'm not alone in the fact that I got angry this morning, or, you know, that we play in a goofy manner.
Right.
I'm not alone in that. I have my ups and downs, and I think reading some of these books makes me feel like I always have downs, and I'm never quite perfect. And the truth is, no one is.
Thanks very much, Christina.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. One of your reviewers wrote that in a way your book is a history of parental anxiety as much as it is about child rearing advice, and I guess Christina's phone call illustrates that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't really say the word child rearing without thinking the word anxiety along with it, and it is very true. We tend to think right now we have never been more anxious about this whole enterprise, but the truth is...
And, of course, we're right.
Well, we are probably right, but the truth is Dr. Holt and Dr. Hall were just beside themselves at how nervous mothers were. And, of course, Dr. Spock's rise was owed to his stepping forth to directly address this concern. And he said, trust yourself. You know more than you think you do. That was a response to a sense that mothers were extremely nervous. And Spock actually was also the first to acknowledge that it wasn't just that experts hadn't solved the anxiety, actually. They might be part of the problem.
Well, you mentioned Dr. Spock. The baby boomers, of course, were raised on Dr. Benjamin Spock. His book was first published, I guess, in 1946. It was called Baby and Child Care. We have a clip of tape now. Let's listen to somewhat later in his career. He's describing what he did for parents.
I think in previous centuries and in the first half of the 20th centuries, parents felt they had to intimidate their children, just the way I was intimidated, scolded all the time, made to feel evil, threatened with loss of love and maybe some kind of punishment. Now, I think that it was Freud and Dewey, particularly, who changed that point of view. Freud said in so many words, it isn't by disciplining or intimidating your children, it's by loving them, then they love you and they want to be worthy of you and they want to grow up to be mature people like you. In other words, it's the love between parent and child that makes them mature and become responsible. And I think it was Dewey who said, you don't have to force children to learn, they're wild to learn. I think both of these philosophers gave parents more trust in their children. I think my job was to translate this into ordinary language and apply it to ordinary home situations. And that what the book really says is not only trust yourself as a parent, it says trust your children.
We all, of course, came to trust Dr. Spock, but one of the fascinating things about that clip of tape, you know, just as I was dominated and intimidated as a child, one of the fascinating things you go through in this book is to write about the how these men, and they were very largely men, were raised and how much influence that had on what they later propounded as scientific advice.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. We had your mic out there for a second.
Sure. One of the things that inspired me to go write the book in that way was actually Dr. Spock himself, who was one of the people who most articulately said, you know, the way we get our ideas about rearing children is mostly from the way we were reared ourselves, as much as from any advice or science we're going to ever consult. And that was certainly true of him. His mother was a ardent follower of Dr. Holt, and this, you know, seemed to him to say all that needed to be said. And certainly his, you know, he conceived of his advice as definitely a reaction to the way he had been brought up. But he also felt, as he revised his book many times, that in the end he came back to a surprising sort of degree of affinity with his own moralistic mother. So.
And at the same time, though there was this dichotomy of two in each, one in each camp throughout much of the history of the century that you trace, you really find that Spock ended up with a foot in each camp.
He did. I mean, he is the one exception to the rule that sort of proves it. He was the unchallenged expert of mid-century, and there has never been anyone like him since, and there was never anyone like him before. And the way he achieved this utter dominance was that he aimed for the middle, unlike most of his predecessors and his successors. But even he had to do a sort of balancing act. I mean, his 1946 edition was hailed when it came out as striking a wonderful middle ground. But Spock himself, almost within about 5 years of its appearance, suddenly became worried that it was too permissive, and his second edition represented as his effort to be his own balance.
We're talking about the varied and often contradictory child-rearing advice Americans have been getting for the past 100 years, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Do you parent differently than your parents did? Give us a call. Or send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how child-rearing experts have been confusing and helping parents for over 100 years. Joining us is Ann Hulbert, whose new book is Raising America Experts, Parents, and a Century of Advice About Children. If you'd like to join our discussion, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And there is value, isn't there, in some of these books? I mean, nervous parents have to turn somewhere.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's always wisdom in each of them. What you don't find in any of them is a total system that will answer all your questions. And in fact, I think what you see when you put a century of advice sort of all together, as I've tried to do in this book, is you see something that's actually quite reassuring, which is that we tend to think that there's all kinds of ways to do it, and there are all kinds of dilemmas that present themselves. The truth is, actually, they do come down to these two basic choices. We're always trying to steer our way through the middle of them, and that even the dilemmas that confront us tend to be sort of versions of problems that have cropped up before.
And they seem to be reflections of that long debate over nature and nurture.
They definitely do. I think it's interesting that you know, you do find at the turn of the century a kind of preoccupation with the kind of question of whether children will weather this entry into a complicated world or whether they're going to be too hurried, which really was definitely the preoccupation of Holt and Hall. You see the same thing now. Are we hurrying our children too much? Is the world too complicated and forbidding a place? And the two kinds of advice you get are, again, are we need to, you know, impose a kind of order and discipline on them that will help them weather this, or we need to find more room for their own natures to unfold. It's a similar, you know, predicament. Obviously, all kinds of conditions are different, and yet the same questions arise.
Let's go now to Grace, who joins us from Arvada, Colorado.
Hi, Neil. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have been saying, I have a one-year-old. It's my first child, and I've been saying ever since I had the baby, I was given one book when I was pregnant. And I've been saying, if there was one thing I could do to change the world, it would be to make sure that every new mom read this book. It's called 25 Things Every New Mother Should Know by Dr. William Sears.
And what in it did you find particularly valuable?
I thought that it really helped me to tune into my baby and her needs and kind of come up with something that worked for us, and we kind of fell into a routine, and we became, you know, very bonded very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. And
I can take my comment off the air.
Okay, that's good. Thank you very much for Grace.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Is that one you're familiar with?
Yes. Dr. Sears is one of the proponents of something that I think now goes by, as a lot of parenting techniques do, a sort of brand name called attachment parenting. And I think his view is that the more physical and constant intimate contact you have with your child, the more attuned you are to your own child's particular temperament and needs. He's an advocate of sleeping with your baby, and there are plenty of people who don't think that's the way to do it, which only is sort of proof of, the constant debate. There are those who would argue that, in fact, the family bed is a threat to the development of autonomy and individuality. And Dr. Sears represents, you know, has the foot in the definite soft bonding camp.
We have an email from Edwin Okongo, who writes, I was born in Africa, where corporal punishment is very common. Everything I was taught was by the whip. I did not see it as abuse until I came to the USA 9 years ago. I want to have kids, but I'm scared I might hurt them. What should I do?
That's a fascinating question. I mean, the whole issue of spanking, of course, has been one that's been incredibly charged from the turn of the century to now. What's very interesting is how much a subject of debate it has been. There has never been a period in which there was a view firmly on one side or the other. I think this man would discover now that he can find experts who will tell him that, you know, chastisement of a physical kind has a perfectly central place in child rearing. He will also find experts who will tell him that is absolutely the wrong thing to do. We live in an aggressive world, and to spank your child is only to encourage aggression. I think it's sort of interesting that the American Academy of Pediatrics basically adopted the position against corporal punishment of any kind, then did a poll of its own pediatric membership and discovered that 4 out of 10 pediatricians acknowledge that some, you know, spanking of a normative kind, obviously they're not talking about fierce, yep, abusive spanking, is something that they say can be in the repertoire of a parent. Whatever one makes of polls like this, I do think they're probably, I think it's been said that 90% of Americans say that they have spanked, which is not to say, of course, we don't know what it's to say. We don't know whether they do it regularly. They sometimes do it and always wish they didn't. But it's a complicated question. And there is no science, I think, of a definitive kind to tell you for sure which way you should go. In fact, a very reputable researcher recently reviewed what research had been done and said it's weak enough that, you know, you can't conclude much. But as far as she could tell, absolutely no clear-cut evidence one way or the other.
Let's go to Kim, who's on the line with us from Boston.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on the air.
Sure.
I just wanted to add a comment. I'm a new mom. I've got a 2-year-old, and I was bombarded with a whole bunch of books, and the one that I think struck a chord with me was also Dr. Sears. His book, I think it's called The Baby Book, Age 0 to 3 or something like that. And I think what it was about the book that struck with me was the fact that it confirmed my instincts, and I felt it wasn't judging me for, I didn't feel like I was being judged for what I wanted to do with my child, and kind of felt confirmed that what I was doing was right.
Did it have, did what you describe as your instincts, did they have anything to do with the way you were raised, and was this a reaction towards or against that?
I think it was maybe perhaps against it. I mean, I think I was just looking for, I guess I'm the type of person that wants to really examine everything and feel like I'm getting doing the best thing I can possibly do for my child, and I felt I needed some more information in that. So I read quite a few books, and a lot of them didn't really speak to me until I read Dr. Sears' book. I guess that's how I felt once I read his book. And it's pretty overwhelming. And I think, as you said earlier, attachment parenting is definitely considered like kind of the softer side of parenting. And not a lot of my friends do it that way. And it's hard to... sometimes it's hard to kind of stand by your beliefs, but I find that I need to go back to that book to feel like validated, I guess, to say, you know, what I'm doing is right, and, you know, feel like what I'm doing is the right thing for my child.
Isn't that an arresting moment, though, when you talk to friends who you think, you know, more or less hold the same worldview that you do, mm-hmm, and find that they do things very differently?
Yeah, and I think about Dr. Sears is he's not saying that his way is the only way. And, you know, so I find that I try not to judge my friends for, you know, if they Ferberize their baby, I'm not going to think less of them because their children are just as wonderful as my child.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just whatever's right for your family is what you have to do.
Okay. Well, thanks very much and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I wonder, do new parents particularly look for books that reinforce what they already believe?
I think they definitely do. I mean, I think... the advice that one is generally given about advice is to do just that. There's a huge array of advice out there, and you can get lost. What you should do is basically try to zero in on what seems to you to chime in with your own philosophy, insofar as at that point you have a philosophy, which often one doesn't. And I think that's what most parents do, certainly at the outset.
But especially now when there is so much different kinds of advice, there's no sort of acknowledged authority as I guess maybe 40 years ago Dr. Spock was.
That's definitely true. I mean, I think a lot of what new parents do is still the old friend word of mouth. You have a friend who's read Dr. Sears and says, you know, you might want to look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone does, I think, know about Dr. Brazelton and Dr. Leach, and they know there is that set of books. Everyone knows about the What to Expect books. And you can go and look at a shelf, and you can sort of get some sense of what is out there. And I think that's the way parents do it. The word of mouth, particularly on the whole sleeping issue, which is such a hot one at the moment, is definitely passed around among the mother and father networks.
Let's go to Gary, who's on the line with us from Buffalo, New York.
Thank you, Neil, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting subject. I really appreciate your having it on. I had a discussion with my daughter this past week, and she's a mother of a 6 and a 2-year-old, so I'm the grandparent, but these are both adopted kids, not that that makes any difference. But she recently had a discussion with her 6-year-old's kindergarten teacher actually a pair of teachers, and they're recommending that she hold him back. And the reason is not because...
Hold him back a year in school?
Yes.
Okay.
And in kindergarten. And the reason is not because he is not smart or not because he's not capable of doing the work, but because of social skills. And this, my daughter, is a person who read everything, but in my opinion, then became the absolute perfect mom. Not because she's my daughter, but she became the perfect mom. She devoted herself to this child and spent 24/7 with him and played music, alphabet, everything. Brought this child up in what was at that time considered an absolutely perfect way, and this is the result. And part of the wisdom is that had he been put in daycare a little bit, he would have had better social skills. And, of course, this is becoming some of the common wisdom, that daycare actually does help kids. And so I'd like to get some comments on that, and I'll take the comments off the air.
Okay, Gary, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye. The raising your kid in the absolutely perfect way.
Well, what a granddaughter. I mean, what a daughter with her grandchildren. You might be sort of interested to know that this whole debate about whether you should or shouldn't send your late 5-year-old or 6-year-old to kindergarten goes back at least, let's see, it's 4 decades. Arnold Gazelle, who's one of the characters I talk about in my book, was one of the people who developed what's known as the kindergarten readiness test, which was, as I'm sure your daughter has since discovered, supposed to assess various skills. And because Dr. Gazelle was very concerned that kids were being sent on way too soon to academic rigor when they needed longer time to mature, I think he would have counseled that you certainly shouldn't blame your own time spent with your child in the first 4 years for his slow social maturation. He would have said, this is the kind of child you have. He's on his own timetable. Let him take his time. He certainly wouldn't have wanted you to be judging yourself as to, you know, whether the treatment you gave the child was somehow inopportune and led to his lag.
You were talking about how this was largely a middle-class phenomenon, and the Americans like to see themselves as middle-class, but it was mostly white middle-class, almost exclusively, certainly in the beginning. Is this phenomenon the same with African-American and Latino parents?
Well, I do think that there is a sense, and there was an article in the late 60s by someone writing, you know, what we need is actually a Dr. Spock for African-American parents. And I do think now there is an increasing literature that is aimed more at some of the special dilemmas facing families of who are in different social predicaments than your middle-class families. I do think that it still remains. If you go look on the bookshelves, it is a dominantly white, mainstream, middle-class literature.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email we got from John Tamaresis. Ann Hulbert's discussion of parenting advice reminds me of the following joke. Before becoming a parent, I had 6 theories and no children. After becoming a parent, I have 6 children and no theories. So you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our guest is Ann Hulbert. Her new book is Raising America Experts, Parents, and a Century of Advice About Children. And let's go to Sarah, who joins us from Sacramento.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
First, I'd like to say I'm a mother of 5, and I think that our children would be in a much better state if more people looked at parenting as a vocation, to tell you the truth. Because your guest had mentioned how at some point in the turn of the century, people had viewed motherhood as a vocation, and indeed it is. Anyhow, what I'd like to say is, as far as books go, I think it really helps just a straightforward child development book so you know what to expect from your children at a certain age. Sometimes I think people expect too much or too little at certain ages, and that's helped me a lot.
Though you want to be careful, don't you, to be, not too didactic. You know, you can't expect that, oh, my gosh, she's supposed to have rolled over by now or whatever it is.
Is that towards me?
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah,
definitely. I'm actually thinking about a little bit older, but I think, you know, a lot of people don't understand the child development ages, and so they're expecting their 3-year-old to follow along in a ballet class perfectly. I've seen that a lot, or, you know, so I think just knowing child development really well helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're doing some vocational work right there.
I am indeed.
How old are they?
I've got 10, 5, three and two twins.
You're busy.
Yeah, but you know what? I love it, and it is a vocation.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Sarah.
You bet.
Appreciate it. That's, you know, that's obviously a lot of work. A lot of women are overwhelmed simply by one, not to mention Sarah's workload. I mean, she's obviously having a wonderful time with her children. But isn't that a lot of the reason why this has become such a big business?
Oh, absolutely. And I do think that the greater the pressures are on mothers and fathers and the more time they spend away from their kids, the more daunting an enterprise it is. I mean, which isn't to say that it's easy to be home with children all day either, but I think when you're feeling pressed by other demands, you're feeling a little bit less in touch with your child than you wish, you don't feel as though you've gotten into grooves as a parent, you do want as much advice as you can get.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Spock's book was such a runaway bestseller, totally unexpected. They put no advertising into it. I think your book says it was sold 750,000 copies in its first year, and this has become such a huge business. At the same time, you write about how many of these experts aren't really researchers, they're popularizers, and often sneered at a little bit by their colleagues on the science side.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think not least because to be a popularizer means you are not a indefatigable researcher and you're not on offering cutting-edge wisdom, and because it often means that you're making pretty big leaps from evidence to prescription, it doesn't tend to win you high prestige in the academic world.
Let's get a call from Robin in Falmouth, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I think you've left out the most important set of books. do you know Adele Faber and Elaine Maslisch? They've written How to Talk to Children, so children will, How to Talk So Children Will Listen, and How to Listen When Children Talk. And they wrote Liberated Parents, Liberated Children. And most importantly, they wrote Siblings Without Rivalry. And those are three absolutely incredible books. They have changed my relationships with everybody I know.
How about with your mother?
Including my mother. Because the premise of their books is that you feel how you feel, and you should never tell anybody else how to feel. And, you know, if you watch your children when you're having a conversation with them, the one thing that's bound to let them go completely out of control is you tell them, you shouldn't feel that way. And with siblings, like when the new sibling comes home and the other one says, I hate the baby, the last thing you should say is, no, you don't hate the baby, you love the baby. You should... They have this great, in Siblings Without Rivalry, they have this great thing about, let's say you...
Got to wrap it up, Robin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, if your husband brings home a second wife, how you would feel, and they compare that to when the new baby comes home. So maybe after your break, she can comment on these books. I don't want to take too much time.
Okay, well, thanks. I think you're going to get the last comment because we're going to go to another story after the break, but thanks very much for the call. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Ann Hulbert is the author of a new book, Raising America, Experts, Parents, and a Century of Advice About Children. And when we do come back, Michael Jordan leaves not just the floor, but the Washington Wizards altogether, and not happily. I'm Neil Conan. We'll take your calls on that after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.